the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware Peek. This morning, Scott Greenberg and I speak with Scientific American journalist Stephanie Pappas. She writes about a new study showing how bird flu may be airborne. Then best-selling author Mary Roach takes us on a wild ride through the strange, ingenious, and sometimes surreal quest to rebuild and transplant parts of the human body. It's all in her new book, Replaceable You. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
I'm Scott Greenberg, and for months, the bird flu outbreak on U.S. dairy farms has raised questions about how exactly the virus is spreading. A new study suggests the answer may be blowing in the wind, literally. Researchers have detected traces of the H5N1, not just in milk and wastewater, but also drifting through the air on dairy farms.
If this is true, this airborne route could change how we think about the risks to farm workers, the food supply, and even the possibility of future human transmission. We're joined this morning by science writer Stephanie Pappas, who wrote an article about the spread of bird flu on dairy farms in Scientific American in August. Stephanie, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you have written quite a lot about bird flu in the last while. When did it come onto your radar as a science writer?
Well, I think it really started to pick up around 2022 when we started seeing these big die-offs of marine mammals in South America. You might remember this from the news headlines. All of a sudden, sea lions were dying in mass, and it was this big change in what we'd seen in bird flu. Because that virus had been circulating since 1996. Occasionally, it would cause one-off human infections, but there wasn't a lot of mammal-to-mammal spread. And that changed in 2021 when there was kind of a new lineage that developed in Europe, and it started to spread around the world. And as that spread happened, we started to see more and more mammal infections and more mammal infections that were showing that it wasn't just a cat ate an infected bird and got sick, but the mammals were spreading it to each other somehow. And that was new. And then as this virus spread, it was in 2024 that it started to appear on dairy farms. The sudden appearance in cattle was really surprising to scientists. I had two separate scientists tell me the exact words, flu in dairy cattle is not a thing. But it became a thing. It became a thing very suddenly. And I think, as we have seen with the COVID pandemic, when things start to change with the virus, you want to be paying attention. You want to see, could this possibly be something that's going to spread between humans as well?
Yeah. Well, Scientific American in August did sort of, it was the cover story with a lot of different articles on bird flu. And just so we can prime our listeners about this, I mean, we'll talk about the risk of human infection, but you know, everyone knows, everyone who eats eggs knows that the supply chain of eggs has been, you know, eggs are expensive now, and it's because of bird flu. Take us through that one.
Yeah, so we started to see really big poultry outbreaks. That is a really tricky problem on its own to solve. Scientists have not been entirely sure how the bird flu is getting into poultry farms, but migratory birds spread this through their droppings as they travel through water, probably through air. This has long been a disease that affected migratory waterfowl, but when it gets into chickens, we see just massive die-offs. They do not survive this disease. And so when it happens on a farm, they generally have to cull the entire flock, which means that we see the price of eggs go up quite a lot. And so that was occurring throughout the year last year, and trying to get a handle on that was very difficult as they were doing new biosecurity measures, but this virus is really hard to contain.
Well, we mentioned in our introduction that this could literally be blowing in the wind. And I'm curious, how did the researchers, actually led by Seema Lakdawala's lab at Emory University, go about actually even identifying the virus in airborne particles?
Yeah, such a good question. So this is really kind of interesting because when this first started appearing on dairy farms, everyone said, well, it's the milking equipment. You know, this is infecting their udders. It causes mastitis in cows. They actually survive, unlike birds. And so it seemed obvious. This is going from the milking equipment that they put on the different cows' udders. But there was a small study in kind of a biocontainment facility at Ohio State University where they put a sick cow and a well cow, and they milked them just as they would on a dairy farm, sharing the equipment over the course of 2 weeks, twice a day. The cow did not get sick, which was really shocking because they knew that if they kind of took a swab of the virus and stuck it in the cow's teat, it would get sick. So it was very odd to them that the milking equipment wasn't spreading it very effectively. We saw that it was happening on farms. So Lakdawala's group wanted to look at the whole environment. A dairy farm is not very similar to kind of a science lab where you can just have a couple of cows. So they took equipment, they took swabs of surfaces, they took samples of wastewater, they took samples of milk, they took airborne samples. They have these like little portable devices and they can sample just the ambient air. They also have these devices that kind of look a little bit like a handheld vacuum cleaner or a dust buster. They can put right up to the cow's face and let the cow exhale, and they can see where these particles are. So that is their specialty, is actually finding viral particles in the environment. And that's how they were able to see that, yes, this virus was, as she said, everywhere. It was on the surfaces, in the milk, in the water, and in the air.
You took the words out of my mouth. It is everywhere. And I'm just curious how the level of environmental contamination alters our understanding now of, as you said, equipment to equipment or farm to farm. And I think what most of us are concerned about is animal to human transmission.
Right. So as far as how to understand this for the cattle to cattle transmission, it is kind of I believe the word Dr. Lakdawala uses is over bombardment, because the virus is everywhere. The cows are breathing it. They are getting it on the milking equipment. They're probably licking it off their own bodies. That means that farmers are going to have to consider all of these different ways when they're trying to think about biosecurity. So one example is that when they dump milk that they can't, you know, sell at the market, they may need to treat that milk so that it's not just going into the wastewater untreated. And that can be as simple, perhaps, as something like adding vinegar or lemon juice to kind of kill the virus. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a, antibiotic or something. They need to probably think about how they wash down the barns, because as they spray hoses of water, that kind of creates, you can imagine the spray from the hose creates these little tiny particles that hover in the air. And biosafety for the workers could be things like face masks, which will keep droplets off their face, masks, if that's feasible. All of these kind of different things are going to have to be ways that they try to contain the virus. One promising thing they did see in this study is, so far we have not seen major mutations in the virus that would help it spread easily among humans. And so, yes, we can catch this virus. We have seen several dozen cases in dairy farmers. Often it appears as pink eye because the virus is very good at clinging to the little lining of our eye. Mm-hmm. It's not so good at getting into our upper respiratory system. And so far, that's really good news.
Mm. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science writer Stephanie Pappas. She's been writing about avian flu, bird flu, H5N1. Do you find yourself calling it just bird flu instead of H5N1?
A lot easier.
And we're talking about the spread of bird flu on dairy farms among cattle. Recent studies show that it's airborne. I'm curious about the human cases that have been found on dairy farms. So the CDC has found 41 human cases directly stemming from contact with milking cows, you say in your article. So is that also the airborne that it's contacted from or contracted from being airborne, breathing the virus?
Yeah, so the environment in a milking parlor is very saturated with virus. So I would say that, yes, we're probably seeing that airborne transmission. They may also be getting contact transmission from milk splashing. I actually spoke to one scientist who studies viruses who grew up on a dairy farm, and she said milk is everywhere. You can't understate how much contamination a worker is experiencing. And so we are probably seeing all of those different avenues making a difference for workers, and it's probably that heavy bombardment of virus that is leading to these direct infections.
Yeah. And when a human is infected with bird flu, what kind, you know, you talked about pink eye, but how serious of an issue is it?
So historically, this has been a really worrisome disease because we did see high rates of death in cases we detected. Now, that probably means a lot of cases have gone without detection, which means we don't really know how many people have really been infected. So the death rate's probably a little lower than some of the more alarming numbers. I think the first outbreaks in Hong Kong in 1997, they saw 18 cases and 6 people died, which would obviously be really horrifying. In the farm workers, we have actually seen mostly mild illness, and that probably has to do with the fact that it is infecting the eyes and is not really getting deep into the lungs, where we do have receptors deep in our lungs that can bind to this virus. This virus can get into our cells, but because it doesn't cling very well to our upper airways, the virus often doesn't get deep into the lungs. In these cases with the farm workers, we're kind of seeing it as an upper pink eye and mild illness, whereas some of the people who have died, we've had a handful of deaths. They might be breathing it deep in their lungs from we've seen a lot of deaths with poultry-related cases, mm-hmm. and that might be because it's getting into those receptors deep in our lungs.
An additional question about that as you were talking, it was making me think about, you know, the concept of a vaccination, for example. You know, we're exposed to a little bit of the virus in a vaccine and our body creates a natural immunity to it. And it makes me wonder about dairy farm workers, if they are constantly, you know, exposed to it a little bit and therefore build up antibodies. And that's maybe why they also, you know, other than, as you say, they're not breathing it deeply into their lungs. Has there been any study about that sort of thing?
Well, we have seen that in one study of dairy farm workers, about 7% had antibodies to bird flu, suggesting they'd been exposed and cleared it, and not all of them had ever realized they'd had it. So yeah, you will mount this immune response. I don't think we know yet if that's protective enough if they were to be like more heavily exposed. I think that's a big question just because the overall number of human cases has been fairly low. But we do have vaccines against H5N1 strains. They're older strains than this current one that's circulating, but they probably are effective against the virus, according to most scientists. So if we were to see some kind of outbreak, we do have a head start in terms of vaccination.
We know that viruses are constantly mutating, and I believe your article mentions a mutation found in one viral sample. What is its significance? Should people be concerned about the potential for this virus to adapt more readily to humans?
Yes, so people should be a little concerned. Right now, the risk to the public's really low. And the problem with flu viruses is they're really good at what scientists call reassortment. If they come into contact with other flu viruses, they grab genes from those viruses and they can kind of do a quantum leap in evolution. And so one day they can't infect humans, they interact with another virus that can, and they grab that, you know, piece of genetic code and incorporate it. So that's the concern really, is that as it circulates in animals, especially in animals that humans interact with, that unlucky moment happens. So there's a few things that would have to happen, though. One of the big ones is the fact that the kind of receptors we have on our cells are not the same as the ones that are in cow udders or birds. And so the virus has to kind of do this switch to be able to adapt to more human or respiratory cells. And luckily, we haven't seen that happen yet. The sample they saw on the farm did show some mutations in an area of the virus that's known to potentially give it an ability to infect humans. But they don't know if that mutation actually would have helped it in any way, right? They just saw, oh, that's an area we don't like to see it changing. Luckily, whatever was going on there, that died out. It didn't continue to spread. But it does show that this virus is kind of always trying new things. And this can happen over like a very long time span. So the example I like is we have probably all heard of the 1918 pandemic flu that spread across the world and continued to circulate. Its ancestors continued to circulate at a low level throughout the population in the next decades. In 2009, we had the pandemic swine flu. And what was really odd about that was older people had some level of immunity to it. And you never see that with flu, really. Older people generally are sicker. They figured out it's because that 2009 flu had come from a mixture of different flu viruses with that old ancestor of 1918, descendant of 1918. So the older people had been exposed to this kind of part of this virus. But it just goes to show that was, you know, almost a century later, we start to see like, oh no, it has done something. So we're going to have to keep monitoring this is really the answer.
Well, it's nice to know that there is some of the benefit for me being older now. I hope. So the old saying, right, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. As we continue to deal with this bird flu, particularly on farms, are they putting in any kind of biosafety or biosecurity measures at farms? Are they doing more rapid testing? Are they using maybe face shields or different kind of protective equipment? How are we thinking about just good old-fashioned preventative measures to prevent this spread?
Yeah, so there have been some measures put into place, like restrictions on transferring cattle across state lines. I think individual farms are working with their health departments and the CDC to put in things like protective equipment for workers. There is more monitoring. And actually, in the last 30 days, there have not been any detected cases in dairy farms. So we've really seen it fall off. And there's a little bit of a question mark as to why. Probably some of these protective measures are making a difference. We also do tend to see bird flu decline in the summer and then come back up in the spring and fall when migratory birds are moving through. So we're just going to have to be keeping an eye on that in the next few months. And another step that scientists say farms could take is basically create, you know, at-home tests for bird flu, just like we had during COVID, where you could just drop a sample and in 5 minutes know whether the virus was there. So that's something that people are talking about and working on developing so that we can get a more rapid assessment at the site.
Yeah, interesting. Well, because you have also written on bird flu and how it has passed through chicken farms, devastating them and you know, as you talk about, well, as we've all experienced, causing periodic shortages of eggs and eggs being more expensive. What is the update on that? I mean, has it, you know, if you're talking about migratory birds dropping the bird flu onto chicken farms, it's funny, it makes you think about, you know, we like the farm-raised, you know, chickens that are out in the pasture, but gosh, if suddenly they're getting bird flu dropped on top of them, maybe we turn back to those that just stay in the huts, you know?
It's a real problem, right? We have not traditionally thought of farms as kind of a locked down environment, but I did speak to one scientist who said, we need to think about hygiene on farms more generally. Like, this is something we need to really rethink. You know, the way we thought about rethinking our factories that made processed foods back in the early 1900s. Right now, we are not seeing a lot of poultry outbreaks either, which is great news. I think the current USDA numbers put it at only 4, which compared to the beginning of the outbreak since 2022, there have been 1,713 flocks affected, which is a whopping 175 million birds. So having it at only 4 flocks right now is good. But we do continue to see detections of bird flu in wild birds. And even this past week, there was a case in California where a cat died from eating raw cat food that was made from chicken. So public health officials are warning people, this is still in the environment. Please avoid raw milk. Please avoid dead birds, because we can expect this is going to continue to circulate at some level.
Yeah, I've been wondering that question about, you know, it bird flu appearing in milk, in cow's milk, and the pasteurization process no doubt eliminates that possibility. But, you know, there's a big movement of people who really think raw milk is the thing to have and to do. What are those kinds of tests looking like in the raw milk?
We certainly see the virus persisting in an infectious state in raw milk. So it is just not a great idea. Of course, a lot of things persist in an infection state in raw milk, so it's not a great idea in general. As we mentioned about hygiene, these milking parlors are not particularly clean places. And so you have to think that this pasteurization is a godsend, and you really want to be avoiding raw milk.
You know, it's so interesting. I recently had dinner with somebody who actually makes egg cartons, if you can imagine. They are an egg carton manufacturer, and they got into the business because their father-in-law was a poultry farmer. And fortunately, they're out of the poultry farming business because just after they sold their poultry farm, they lost 2/3 of their flock to the bird flu. They had to, destroy the chickens, which was absolutely terrible. I'm just so thrilled to hear that there's an end in sight. At least there's been a reduction, currently a reduction, I should say. And why are we not vaccinating chickens? Is that something we can't do in the United States?
Such a good question. The vaccination of chickens is more of an economic call than anything else, because if we vaccinate chickens at this time, the rules are such that we can't export that meat. And that's because the concern is that, as we kind of know from other respiratory viruses, when you get a vaccination, you don't necessarily not get a little sick, right? It keeps you from dying, but you may still get sick, and it's possible you could transmit the disease. And so the fear has been that it'll basically cover up active bird flu and spread it around more. That's not a universal thing. Some places do vaccinate chickens, and there's been talk about, you know, maybe we should consider it in the U.S., but it would require kind of a regulatory change. And that's going to be a process. I think it's going to be a conversation, especially if we continue to see chicken flocks succumbing to this, you know, if we see that again during this fall and spring.
Yeah, well, it's such an interesting conversation, and because you've been so close to it and you've researched so much, you know, A, what are you writing about next? And B, is it something that you feel like is just cycling and that, you know, we can let it ride for a while now?
But I think that this is just going to be something that we are going to continue to follow, because it's now a background threat, right? We're interested in how this evolves over time as it continues to spread. One big question now is, do we kind of have some herd immunity in some of these dairy cow herds because they do recover? Will they be getting sick again? Will they not? We don't know that. And a lot of the question, I think this will, the monitoring of this virus should answer some questions over time about, you know, how flu evolves, how it learns to jump from species to species. And flu has and will cause future pandemics. I think that's safe to say. Since 1918, there have been 4 other flu pandemics. So it's not really a super rare occasion that we see new flu viruses that can infect humans coming from animals. And that's just going to be something that we always have to keep monitoring and keep an eye on.
Yeah. Gosh, can I ask you, since 1918, what are those 4 pandemics?
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you right now, some of these names are not things we would name viruses now because we stopped naming them after the places we think they arose. And that's because we usually are not quite right about where they arose. But I'll use these names because they might be more familiar to people. There was in 1957 to 58, what they called the Asian flu. I actually recently found out that one of my mother's friends died of this flu, as a child. I was really she told me that her friend had died in about 1957. I said, wait a minute. There was a pandemic then, Mom. 1968 to 69, there was the Hong Kong flu. In 1977, there was a pandemic flu called the Russian flu, and then we had the 2009 swine flu. None of these were quite as life-altering for everyone on the globe as COVID was, but a part of that is because we do have vaccines for flu and the ability to kind of rapidly respond to flu in a way we hadn't really dealt with the coronaviruses before, at least on a broad scale.
Interesting. Well, our guest is Stephanie Pappas. She is a science writer who writes quite frequently for Scientific American. And she has been talking to us today about her article from August, but also an article she wrote in July, all about bird flu and how it spreads. So Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. My next guest, Mary Roach, is a best-selling author who brings humor and curiosity to science, from cadavers to space travel to the quirks of the human body. She's back with a new book titled Replaceable You, Adventures in Human Anatomy. From really brass noses to pig hearts, she dives into the bizarre, the brilliant, and sometimes unsettling quest to rebuild the human body. And what this all means for the future of medicine, we will discuss today. Mary Roach, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much, Lynn. I'm delighted to be back.
Let's just start off, because I did say brass noses to pig hearts. We have heard about pig hearts. What in your research did you find is happening with pig hearts being viable?
Pig heart, yeah. Pig hearts, it's called xenotransplantation. And the idea is that you could genetically tweak a pig such that its organs, you can knock out this protein, alpha gal, so that the heart is a little bit less human, a little bit less triggering to the human body. So you could install a pig heart and the person wouldn't have the same virulent rejection that they normally would if you went and just took an unadulterated pig organ and put it in a human. You'd get a very quick, rapid, extreme rejection reaction. So you don't have that. The person still has to be on immunosuppression. It's still not there yet, but we do have a man with a kidney going on 8 months. It's an eGenesis kidney. He's doing okay, and that's the longest surviving patient to date. There were quite a few who made it about 2 months. But the thing to keep in mind is that those were patients who were pretty sick. They were patients who they were allowed to have this transplantation done on a compassionate care exemption. So, even though these adulterated hearts haven't yet been FDA approved, they make exceptions when it's a matter of life and death, and then that enables the researchers to get more data and to try it out. So those were pretty sick patients. The gentleman who has a pig kidney now was in better shape. So he's still going, which is exciting.
Wow. So this is all this new world of regenerative medicine, which, has been around. If you think about replacing parts, you can go back many, many decades to dentures, and teeth are parts. They're our parts. But it's interesting that you said that in order for us not to reject something like a pig heart, we have to do something to ourselves to rearrange this protein, did you say, so that we...
It's actually done to the pig.
Okay.
The pig, it's a gene edit that knocks out this protein that really is a sort of a red flag for the human body to be like, get this out of here. This is not me. This is very foreign. I don't like it. So by knocking that out, you put the person closer to the scenario of receiving someone else's, another human's organ.
Right.
Yeah.
And very interesting when it's like you've got nothing left to lose. It's life or death anyway.
Right.
So there's, yeah, nothing left to lose. However, I understand that the genesis of this book came from a woman that you spoke to who it was not a matter of life or death. It was an elective amputation. Tell me about that and how it piqued your curiosity.
Sure. This was one of the things that really got me interested in the topic of replacing bits and pieces of the human body and the notion of the human being as either a whole system or a conglomeration of bits and pieces. She'd had spina bifida, and as a result, her foot was twisted and it didn't perform the way she wanted it to, the way, you know, she couldn't walk right. She had had a number of surgeries already, and she would see people with a lower leg prosthetic hiking, running, doing things that she herself couldn't easily do. And so she was like, why can't I have that? Why can't somebody just amputate my lower leg and give me a prosthetic? And it was very hard for her to find a surgeon willing to do that, because they'd say, well, this is a healthy foot. It has a blood supply. I can't cut it off. And she'd say, yeah, but I can't really walk on it. And I know that I could on a prosthetic limb. So I found that really interesting, that whole, you know, it's kind of the reluctance of surgeons on the one hand and her passion for essentially lopping off her foot.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, you have interviewed so many people, from physicians and engineers and scientists and a patient like her, about all these different kinds of things that would replace our parts. And I'm wondering, in this world that, I mean, you hear about these crazy things every now and again, and then maybe you don't hear about them again. And so of all the things that you research and that you include in the book, you know, what percentage of things do you see going forward? And which percentage do you see, like, everyone's 3D printing things now? Is that going to stick around, or what's the future?
Well, I think that most of the things I looked at in the book are moving forward for sure. I think also, though, that sometimes the press gets ahead of itself in reporting on them, particularly the tech press can get a little overexcited about things. You know, things are happening for sure, but we are not printing 3D organs in a laboratory. We're doing some really cool things in a 3D printing lab, but it's printing organs or growing organs from scratch, whole organs, is still in the realm of science fiction. I have no doubt that it will get there a decade or two down the line, but not right now. And there's a lot of confusion about what is and isn't being done, is possible, what is and isn't possible. So I kind of just wanted to pull back the curtain and step in and see where things are and how they're done and how challenging but exciting it all is.
If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with best-selling author Mary Roach. She's back to discuss her new book, Replaceable You, Adventures in Human Anatomy. Mary, it seems like in the past, all your book titles have one word, and like grunt, like stiff. And you approach science with humor, with this big sense of curiosity that I think is really important if you're going to be a science writer. Because what you want to do is you want to foster creativity and interest in other people. And of course, there's no better way to do it than through humor. So with that signature Mary Roach humor, what is the weirdest replacement part or the craziest notion that you came across?
Oh, the weirdest. Okay, here's one. There's a surgeon in Italy, and I don't know if he's backed off from this, but for quite some time, he was advocating a whole body transplant. Sometimes people called it a head transplant, but you weren't getting a new head. What you were getting, you were the head, and you would get an entire replacement body. So in other words, rather than replacing a failing heart, a failing kidney, a failing knee, you just get a whole new body. And what is really interesting is that this was done in the 1970s on primates. That it was successfully done in the meaning that the head hooked up to a new blood supply survived for a while. It very quickly, rejection set in, like we talked about earlier. So you have a whole new body. Okay, say you set up a blood supply and the head is oxygenated, the brain is working. You can't connect the spinal nerves. So you're basically a head on a pillow, along with other lots of other systemic issues that aren't addressed. But this was something that this surgeon was talking about quite recently, to the point of saying he has a man who's, I think maybe the man had ALS, I can't remember, but he was like, yes, I'll do it. I'll be the head that gets the new body. And then he backed away from it, thankfully.
That's crazy.
I know. And then he came out and said, you know what? We could do it just taking the brain, because if you're going to get a brand new body, why do you want an old wrinkled face? So let's just take the brain and put it in a whole new young body. I'm like, dude.
Science fiction.
Yeah. Anyway, so that I guess is the most outlandish.
Yeah. Well,
transplant I encountered.
Along those lines, I often think about the spinal cord and how we cannot replace a severed spinal cord. What are the adventures and future in that?
Well, I didn't specifically cover the spinal cord, but nerves are tricky. Nobody is printing nerves. Nerves grow slowly. At one point I wondered, well, there've been bilateral arm transplants. Why hasn't there been a leg transplant? And one of the reasons I was given was that the nerves regenerate slowly. And so by the time the nerves would make it all the way down the leg, there would have been atrophy and deterioration. So nerves are hard to regenerate or print or whatever it is you're trying to do, and certainly to connect them. I mean, that's something that would be incredibly exciting, not for replacement body parts, but just for anybody paralyzed with any kind of a cervical break, high up break in their neck. That would, or anywhere really on the spine, that'd be amazing. And I know, I don't know where things are at with that. That wasn't one body part that I focused on. We have a lot of body parts.
There are a lot of body parts. There are some really strange body parts that are being replaced these days by things like fingers.
Oh yeah, this is a technique. It's not widely practiced. In fact, other than this one surgeon in Tbilisi, Georgia, I don't know that anybody is doing this, but I was fascinated. This was a penis reconstruction using the patient's own middle finger. And I heard about this initially from somebody who worked in research, didn't know this man, but told me about the procedure. And I, of course, imagined the finger being removed and implanted as is, like a finger, which is, as you can imagine, the nail is still in place. It can move, it can beckon, I had this and I was like, I need to go there and I need to meet this man. As it turns out, the finger was used as a kind of rigidity aid. There's products, that medical products, inserts, implants that are used for that. I don't know why he elected to use the finger, because I never did meet him, but someone on his staff showed me a lot of slides and images. So I was able to see the penis in question, not in person. Yeah. It's an unorthodox approach to penis reconstruction, but I found it pretty interesting.
Absolutely interesting. Well, I guess it gives rise to this whole world that you were introduced into, which is in part injuries that create the issue that injuries or gosh, what else has happened to these people? Obviously, if it's an organ, if you have a pig's kidney, we know what happened there. You know, if you need new lungs, we know what happened there. But wow, you must have seen some just crazy things, stories.
Yeah, I think the one that really stays with me was that I spent a couple of days in the burn unit at Mass General Hospital in Boston. And the surgery for a major burn, like third degree burns on a large percentage of the body, that's an unbelievable process. And I didn't realize just the risks just from infection initially is often what kills somebody with a huge burn like that. Mm-hmm. But just to see how the cadaver skin is used, some of the newer ways of using cadaver skin, you can actually take the patient's cells, send them offsite and grow a very, very thin layer to use of their own skin, which is nice because if you use cadaver skin, eventually the body starts to, it sloughs off. The body realizes this is not me. Mm-hmm. And it isn't a violent rejection, but it sloughs off, or the surgeon pulls it off because they want it, freshen it up with fresh blood so that because you want an environment where you can install the graft from somewhere on their body and it will be fed with blood. It will regenerate new capillaries. So the process of that, and it's a long process. I mean, the number of surgeries that the person has to have it's tremendous. It's months and months. And another thing has to happen with a third degree burn, the skin doesn't regenerate from below as it normally would. The body tries to close the wound by contracting, kind of like a drawstring effect, and that pulls on the skin. So you have those horrible disfiguring scars where the chin is pulled down to the collarbone or the eye is held open and can't blink, that kind of thing. And those have to be released where you make a cut and let the contraction release, and then you fill in that wound with skin from elsewhere on the body, and then you let that site heal before you can use it again. It's this amazing, ongoing, really hard process, and the surgeon who was doing all that was just an angel. It's a whole relationship, surgeon and patient. It's years.
Absolutely. I know someone who about a year ago had this horrible flesh-eating bacteria, and they have undergone so many surgeries. And I will say that it's looking wonderful. We think of back when we were kids and you'd see someone had a burn and a skin graft. It never looked wonderful, but this is really looking wonderful. Is this widespread now that using cells to grow new skin is?
Yeah, that's called a cultured epithelial autograft. I don't know how widespread it is, but it's far more expensive than using just more traditional cadaver skin grafts. In that case, it's your own skin, so you're kind of skipping a step. There's also spray-on skin, which you could take a cadaver graft, which is kind of a meshed, so you can spread it out like a baby gate kind of. You'd fill in with the patient's own cells to sort of speed the healing. And I think that's those products are fairly widely used. I don't have a number for you, but the other thing about the face is that the head in general is a really good blood supply. So healing can happen. It's much quicker than say on the lower leg or something.
Right. Oh, it's just fascinating. Okay, we better go back to the brass nose. Wow, you'd have a nice, strong Roman nose then, wouldn't you?
The brass nose, the one that I wrote about, belonged to Tycho Brahe. I think I'm saying it right. I used to say Tycho, but anyway, that dude, 1500s. And in the 1500s, Well, actually, I should say that there were plastic surgeries for nasal reconstruction because nasal mutilation going back to like 1500 BC was a form of punishment. And punishment because it's horrible to have your nose hacked off, but also because it's right there in your face and everyone sees it. So it's a deterrent. And so that was a popular kind of punishment for people for whatever they'd done or not done back in the day. So surgeons became adept at doing this procedure where they would take a flap from the forehead or the cheek of skin and loosen it, keep it attached, right? So it has a blood supply, and then turn it over and put it in place to kind of sculpt a new nose. And, you know, it then would have to grow, you know, they wouldn't take it so deep that it wouldn't heal from below. So they would get healing on the patch where they had taken it away. And then it would regrow, it would get start to have a blood supply on the nose. So eventually they could snip it and good to go, new nose. Which is, considering how long ago this was done in India and in Italy, in the 1700s in Italy, there was a Gaspare Tagliacozzi. He devised a way to do this without sacrificing skin on the face. And that is, he took the arm, lower part of the upper arm, and used a patch there. So you had to have a harness holding your hand up. I'm doing this in the Zoom that nobody can see, but it'd have to be held there and you have to have your arm kind of bent like you're checking for BO, right? So and it had to be held there for a couple of weeks while the new blood supply grew in. So amazing that was done. It's kind of the dawn of plastic surgery.
I guess so. This is just so fun. Of all the books you've written, how does this figure into the most interesting to research? Sounds just fascinating.
It was really fascinating, but they've all been really, really interesting. You know, I have a short attention span, and so I always want to dive into something completely new, which is kind of dumb of me in that I have to start all over again from scratch, and I have to, you know, get up to speed on 15 chapters of different material, which can be a little hard to do, but it is an endless education, which is I love.
Well, I have to ask you about butt lifts because, you know, it's there on the page.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard about this thing, but I've never, it is interesting in this, and maybe this is part of my question about elective procedures versus life or death, and where is there more advancement?
Well, follow the money. You know, there's a lot of money in cosmetic treatments. So of course, a lot of effort into developing those and refining those. I don't have the numbers to say, but I have a sense that, alas, more money may go into that than, say, researching improvements in transplantation science. But again, I don't have the numbers. It's just a sense I have.
Okay, so butt lifts.
Buff lifts, yeah, okay. This was a chapter really about fat and moving fat around. That part of the Brazilian butt lift, as it's known, can also include implants, buttock implants. And I do trace some history of buttock implants in the book. But what the surgeon that I watched, what he was doing was taking fat from the love handles mostly and moving it to the buttocks. And what was interesting to me is that the love handle fat, as anybody who's tried to lose their love handles, it's a very stubborn fat. It's the first place you gain weight. That is to say, the first place you get fat if you're gaining and the last place you lose. So it's actually a great fat to be moving, whether you're moving it to someone's cheeks or their butt, because it's going to stick around, which I thought that was, it's the concept of donor dominance. And I learned about that in the hair transplant chapter. So, you know, you can take if a man has male pattern baldness, the hair on the sides and back doesn't fall out. It's not going to fall out. It's not affected by testosterone. So you could take hair from back there, put it on the top, and it's going to stay. Likewise, you could take hair from the head and put it on the lower leg, and it's going to grow. It's going to be long and luxuriant. And I tried to do that. I tried to have follicles. It's a long story why this happened. But I thought it would be interesting for book tour to be able to pull up my pant leg and show people, here's donor dominance at work. Here's a long head hair growing on my leg. Alas, it didn't take. But anyway, so the fat, has, depending on where it is in the body, has different characteristics, and you as a surgeon can take advantage of that.
That's another thing that I have wondered why we haven't figured out is male pattern baldness. Maybe it's just because, and thankfully, many men who become bald say, hey, bald is beautiful. This is me. I'm going with it. I want to ask you about follicle transplant because I had read that you underwent it. So that's all about transplanting the entire follicle, one that's growing well. Why didn't it work on your leg?
I think what I was told was that the lower leg has a pretty meager blood supply as compared with the scalp. So it could just have been they transplanted, I think, two follicular units or maybe even just one. And so that was going to be two hairs. I don't know why I feel like a failure, you know, I'm not sure why. I'm so sad that it didn't work.
Well, then that is, you know, gives rise to my next question is it working for male pattern baldness? Is there?
Oh yeah. For head, a hair transplant, that works well. Hair transplants work very well. The thing is, you kind of have to keep coming back because say you get a strip when you as a bald person first start to have a receding hairline and you fill that area in. Now, as time goes by, the hairline continues to recede and you could have a bald strip behind the hair that you had transplanted. So now you need to go back. So it's a bit of a ongoing.
It's a lifetime commitment.
It is a commitment. Yeah, for sure. So, yeah.
Well, you must have, I think, the best job ever.
Well, yours seems pretty fun, too.
Well, it is. Any way we can turn people onto science, it's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree, especially in this day and age.
Well, the book is Replaceable You, and my guest is best-selling author Mary Roach. Mary, thank you again so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, my pleasure, Lynn. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. And join us next week when we speak with science journalist John Green. He's the author of Everything is Tuberculosis, The History and Persistence of Our Deadliest Infection. Yes, really interesting. Then, James Bellingham, a pioneer in marine robotics and author of How Are Marine Robots Shaping Our Future. That all coming up next week.